Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 32 of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna and I am here with Satya Gunput bringing you part 2 of the episode we recorded about migration, and in our migration series looking at the region of the Punjab, looking at the Southall region of London and the Southall Black Sisters, anti-racist struggles within the South Asian community and how, you know, Asian people were racialized, whether falling into categories of blackness or not, and how they then took to doing this anti-racist work and this work in the community to better their experience here in Britain. And, you know, as you've listened in the first episode already, and if you haven't listened to that one, I would definitely say go back. It's not going to make sense to you too much if you listen to this one first. However, it's still a fantastic episode, so do whatever you like. Yeah, I think you should definitely listen to the first part first. And then come here. And if you have done so, or you listened last week or whenever, I hope you do enjoy this second part as we kind of finish off the stories that we started looking at Kiranjit Ahluwalia, the campaigns and specific movements to the Southall Black Sisters, as well as, you know, systemic issues and versus individual issues when it comes to anti-racist struggles. We also are going to touch on institutional racism in this episode, this war against British history, quote unquote, that seems to be, you know, at play right now in the discipline. And also, of course, the Sewell Report will come back again because, you know, you can't really think about history, unfortunately, without that report at the moment, especially when we're looking at anti-racism in the 60s, 70s and 80s. So I hope you do enjoy this episode as we come back for part two. With Satya Gunput thinking about the region of the Punjab, Southall and the Southall Black Sisters. So thank you for listening and I hope you enjoy.
Their most famous campaign, which was actually turned into a movie with an Indian actress called Aishwarya Rai.
Okay.
It was called Provoked, and it was about the case of Kiranjit Ahluwalia, who was a South Asian woman who killed her husband in self-defense.
Yes.
After he had abused her physically, was violent towards her, and she was initially jailed for I think it was murder or something along those lines. And the Southall Black Sisters launched this huge campaign. I think they got Princess Diana involved as well to free her. And they eventually ended up, it ended up with the law being changed about being provoked in instances of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
So when it came to Kiranjit's case, the Southall Black Sisters, at the time, they were made up people like Rahila Gupta, Pragna Patel, Avtar Bra, and they conducted interviews with her. And they always came back to this idea of sort of izzat or honor within South Asian communities and how sort of a religious aspect of that or these sort of community pressures oppressed women. And it made them really unpopular because they were anti-racist and they were turning around and saying, well, our communities aren't perfect. And for some sort of organizations, anti-racist organizations, that was something they didn't want to hear and they didn't want publicized because their argument was it contributes to the pathologizing of the black male or the South Asian male. in that he's a problem, he needs to be educated, brought out of a stone age, those sorts of ideas. But they took a stand, and I think during this period, they start transitioning more to service provision. So instead of thinking about political campaigning, they start running a domestic violence shelter. And some of those reasons are like pragmatic. So funding decisions in London, the GLC, it favors sort of service provision. So they start leaving those political campaigns behind. But I think if we, like, if we're talking about multiculturalism and things like that, probably one of the most interesting moments in their history is the issue of Salman Rushdie. So Salman Rushdie, at the end of the 80s, he's a Booker Prize winning author. He publishes a book called The Satanic Verses, a fiction book, but it has a depiction of like the Islamic faith of the Prophet Muhammad that offends a lot of people. It leads to the call for the banning of his book, and a fatwa is announced on Salman Rushdie's life. And within the British anti-racism, there are really divergent views about what should happen.
Yes.
But what you hear a lot of at that time, including members of the black sections of the Labour Party, so even someone like Bernie Grant, is that the blasphemy law should be extended to cover Islam, and that British Muslims should not be insulted in such a way. And Southall Black Sisters get together with Women Against Fundamentalism in 1990, and they decide to publish a statement which says, we defend Salman Rushdie's right to write this book. And that's a really dramatic moment. Like I said, someone like Bernie Grant, the MP for Tottenham, he's a huge figure in anti-racism in Britain. Like,
of course.
Really, like, it's like, if you want to know one great historical figure that maybe I should have said as well, is Bernie Grant. right?
Of course.
It is a dividing moment, and it's a controversial moment in sort of how we think about ethnicity, multiculturalism in Britain.
Yeah.
And I think one thing I would say is that there is a before and after for multiculturalism in Britain with that Rushdie incident. Yeah. And I guess when the Southall Black Sisters come out and say that in 1989, it makes it clear this is a black secular organization that will defend the rights of women from a secular standpoint.
Absolutely.
And if I were to say anything, it's that part of their secularism, it matters. It doesn't necessarily mean that they all are atheists or what have you, but it did mean that they thought their political platform was only possible if they were secular.
Yeah.
And I think the way we talk about ethnic diversity in Britain, we talk a lot about faith groups now. There's that way of thinking about communities.
Yeah.
And I think, well, actually, I know. So I was really lucky. I was involved in an event which was in conversation with Rohila Gupta.
Yeah.
And she is a really senior figure in Southall Black Sisters.
Yeah.
Wow. And when I was talking to her, she was really unequivocal that sort of thinking about communities damages her political standpoint.
Yeah.
And she was insistent that the black in Southall Black Sisters matters, and she wasn't going to get rid of it.
Good.
And she was still going to, I think she still wants to use that, the legacy of the sort of political black tradition in Britain to argue for the rights of women of color. And she raised one point I remember in this interview and it's available online.
Okay.
Where can
anyone find that?
Queen Mary's University of London put up In Conversation with Rohila Gupta, I think either on YouTube or Daily Motion or one tube site.
And I'll share it on Instagram and Twitter.
I'll send it to you as well. Yeah.
Perfect.
She said that when she started in activism in Britain, and people were challenging her to say, how can you possibly represent both Caribbean and South Asian communities?
Yeah.
People used to tell her, because South Asian people are predominantly concerned with immigration laws, whereas black kids are predominantly concerned with sort of education, special educational needs, being made educationally subnormal, those sorts of, so there are different issues.
Yeah.
And when I was talking to her it was last year, she said, well, if you come to the Windrush scandal, immigration issues were suddenly the concern of Caribbean communities.
Of course.
And if you turn to the educational performance of Bangladeshi or Pakistani heritage children in schools, those are the concerns of South Asian communities now. And she said, by fragmenting the movement, as she referred to it, really key skills and activism and knowledge of how do you campaign against these things? How do you navigate these really complex bureaucratic systems were lost because, well, because there had been a divide and it was viewed that,
definitely.
Those sort of fragmentations,
And as you said, they're systems, and to fight systems, it really kind of, the individual issues, whilst they are very important to said community at any particular time, the systems are the kind of overarching things that are being broken down as in anti-racist movements. You are trying to attack the systems whilst, you know, at one particular time you might be focused on policing or schooling, as you've said. It is the overarching system in Britain, and it is a system that has to be and had to be, you know, dismantled so that it could work for Black and, well, now I say Black and Asian people, but I guess at that point, Black people and non-white people and newly arrived people from wherever they were in the world. It was that system that had to be broken, not just issue here, issue here, issue here.
And I think that feels really, like what you just said, feels really powerful in light of the fact that we are speaking a week after a government, an independent report came out saying that what is institutional racism? I don't think, it's not, there might be racism, but it's not institutional.
Yeah.
And I think we've talked about this before, but we weren't being podcasted, was that there is a sense that the further away we've got from that period of anti-racism in the 70s and 80s, the more personal race has become, the more personal anti-racism has become, and we've lost sight of those broad ways of describing conditions of British people in this country, people around the world. And it feels... Like you at the beginning, you asked what makes you committed and motivated to carry on in history. Well, something like last week, when you see something like that and you think, this is bizarre.
The comments about, you know, how history should be taught and how we need to think about, you know, British Empire and that kind of thing. And you're thinking in your head, am I just sitting here doing all this research for nothing? Like, am I crazy? Did these things just never happen? You know, we need to reframe slavery in some kind of... positive light, and I know I'm you know exaggerating what was said, but it doesn't make any sense. Well,
I wanted to scream. I think I was very close to screaming when I read it, because
it's astonishing. And it, for me, I think, as you said, race and I think identity politics are really framing how we look at racism and fighting against racism, and it is really, I think, taking away from systemic racism. And then I think about, you know, it is, I don't want to, you know, bash people, but, you know, the man that wrote the report, the like kind of lead author, is, you know, a child of the Windrush generation. And I think, like, you know, what your, yes, okay, your life now materialistically might be better than your parents who came over, or you might feel less, you know, covert racism, but you can't, I think as people, you can't, and I'm, you know, preaching to the choir, but you can't, just because your life is better, you cannot say that these systems are not in place anymore. A system could be in place, but not impact a lot of people within that system, that it should negatively impact, but it doesn't mean that system is not still there. And I have no evidence of these systems changing.
No, you're exactly right. It was, I think, you know, like, in that report, every page effectively amounted to someone saying, there's no such thing as institutional racism, but racial disparities exist in this field.
Yeah.
But there's no such thing as institutional racism.
Well, in this specific field and institution.
There's no racism. Yeah. But it was just bizarre. I think, less I talk about it, the better for my overall well-being.
Absolutely. It is definitely one of those things. And as you said, it is the push and the motivation to keep going with something like history and the discipline of history. I feel like history has always been something like, I don't know, growing up doing history and being so like passionate about it, it was never cool. It was like, oh, you just do history, you read a lot about the past. But now I feel like being a historian is like, in some ways activism. Like, I feel like I'm being, not me personally, being attacked, but the discipline and what we stand for, looking at these histories, trying to reframe British history, trying to look at, you know, all sides of empire, I feel like it's under attack more so. Yeah. And following Black Lives Matter, most institutions will say that things are getting maybe a little bit better, or even if it's in a somewhat tokenistic way. But history, I feel like the war has started. Like, we need to armor up.
So I have this, for ages, I was telling my friend, who is a big believer in the culture war.
Yeah.
I was like, there's no culture war. There's no culture war. And then over the last 3-4 weeks, I was like, there is a culture war and I'm definitely on the front line right now. I completely changed my point of view because it's almost got to be, it's like, it's almost become undeniable at the moment, about statues with National Trust, museums. I think you raised a really interesting distinction, right? So I think at Birkbeck, the idea that a historian might also be doing activism or being an activist in some respects, it's not controversial, because Birkbeck is like a college with a real big history of sort of working class education, left wing politics. But where I did my undergraduate, which was less a place like that,
of course,
it was like a historian can't be an activist because a historian is after some objective truth,
right?
And that annoyed me, and it's why I love Birkbeck so much. And I'm sure things have changed. I hope they've changed.
I'm not so sure.
I'm not convinced.
It's true. As a historian, you can't possibly be objective. I cannot write about a history that my grandparents lived through and not bring my emotions, my feelings to that. And, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me. Anyone writing a history, even if it's not, you know, a family connection or your country of origin or your gender or sexuality, you have to bring your own perspective. That's why we write and not robots. You know, it's not like a computer writes these histories. We write human beings with feeling and past experiences. We are shaped by the scholars around us and the institutions we write for and in. And it's absolutely ridiculous that, you could come at that with kind of a, this is only factual. History is the retelling of facts. It's not. It never has been and never will be.
Because I think about some of the things that, like, the works of history or sort of like tangential fields that most excite me. I think of someone like Stella Dadsey, who wrote Heart of a Race and Black Women in Britain. That's a great history, and it doesn't pretend to be sort of academic detachment. Nope. It's like, this is impossible, I'm writing this.
Yep.
Stuart Hall, you know, he writes beautiful prose.
Yeah.
It's getting at the truth, but it's not academic detachment or anything. Nope. It gets at the truth, but you feel the passion, you feel the force of the argument coming through. Yeah. Paul Gilroy's the same. Amit Wilson, Sivanandan, all these guys are writing really important works for the period I study, and they're not uninvolved. And I guess one sort of liberating thing for me was in my historical work was that understanding. You can let go of those things about academic detachment or objectivity and understand that it doesn't really work.
No, it doesn't exist. It's not possible in the discipline. Absolutely. I feel like we've really come full circle here. You know, we've started off with, you know, migration as this big thing and empire, and we've landed at this report and our role as a historian and, you know, what we have to do and what we do or try to do anyway. And so I don't know. Do you have any other points to make about the Southall Black Sisters? I think you left it in a really good place. I think this idea of, you know, the fact that they were a secular organisation, and I think probably to their strength. And again, as you said, the kind of political base of them not necessarily segregating themselves and saying we're just going to be an Asian organisation. You know, it was the Southall Black Sisters. It used the terms of the time and politicised kind of itself. I just wanted to ask a question, though, since I've thought about blackness. When we have these waves of migration, you know, in my reading of interviews especially, and I think Beryl Gilroy's comes to mind in her book Black Teacher, when she comes to Britain, she often says, I am Guyanese, you know, I am a Guyanese woman now in Britain. However, And I wrote about this in my master's dissertation. My supervisor was really probing these thoughts. She said, think about how Britain racialized Black and Asian people. And for me, it was just Caribbean women that I was writing about. But how maybe in Southall were Asian people from the Punjab, say, and I guess from other regions, they were racialized as Black. Did they adopt Black? They also adopted Blackness, as we think about the Southall Black Sisters. But how, I don't know if you can quantify this with numbers, but how far were they racialized by society? And then how far were they kind of accepting of that label, if that makes sense?
No, it's a really good question. And it makes perfect sense. I think, okay, there are two points to this maybe, okay. Is that there is a generational divide for sure.
Yeah.
So youngsters born in Britain or educated for the most part in Britain in the 70s and 80s, they have expectations of the British state as people born here or people who think of themselves as British.
Yeah.
But maybe their parents didn't bring to the argument. So, and their attachment to what sort of a culture or a political culture, it's about creating a new one. So in that space to look at sort of Black activism and say there's a home for me here as a young Asian man or woman to make my case for equal participation in the British state.
Yeah.
That appeals to sort of a younger group of people. And that's why there is a generational thing about Blackness and our political Blackness. And it may be that that generation of political Blackness has come to an end today or is run out today. That's a whole separate podcast, maybe.
Definitely.
But the other thing to say, I guess, is an important point for Blackness in Southall is East African Asians.
Okay, yeah.
So Southall Black Sisters, Avtar Bra, for example, she comes from, I think, Uganda or Kenya. Okay, well, she comes from East Africa. And these are groups of people who are migrating, who have different class identities, different educational backgrounds.
Yeah.
Especially for women, English language proficiency is perhaps a lot better from East Africa than coming from Punjab.
Absolutely.
And that has an impact for activism and the connections people can make between the Caribbean and South Asia. So.
Yep.
You do have radicals like we've talked about, like Roy Swar or Sivanandan from Sri Lanka or Doshi in Birmingham.
Yeah.
You have these radicals from before, but really Blackness becomes a movement with this generational moment.
Definitely.
In Southall.
Yeah.
For sure. Like it's and I think when we talk about these communities like you, this whole podcast is about, it's like gender, class, ethnic identities. And I would say Blackness in this part of Southall for the Black Sisters, it has its political power because they look at the way they're being racialized and being thought of and they say, how do we use this to our advantage?
Yeah, that makes
sense. How do we make this a coalition where we can achieve things to improve the lives of women in this country? And I think it's true that they are fought as other. They are fought as people from the empire, backwards people, South Asian people sometimes assumed as being passive or dirty or unhygienic. And so all these different racializations, people sometimes fight back against them. And I think especially for South Asian people in Southall, perhaps one undercommented part of reaching towards Blackness is it's an opportunity to shake off the ideas about Asian passivity as well. So being assertive about your identity. So while political Blackness had less to do with like things like Black pride, actually that is something that can't be completely ignored from that politics.
Absolutely.
So when people in Southall, they start reaching towards their Sikh identity as something to be proud of, and they ally that to political Blackness.
Yeah.
And it's a way of thinking about how maybe for the Southall Black Sisters, this Black is a really broad platform.
Yeah.
And the secularism matters, like we've talked about, because that's how it stays broad. Yeah. That's why it tries not to get too bogged down in the specifics of like sort of these really small details and really not achieve anything broad. Like we're talking about like systems or institutions.
Yes, of course. And not just personal politics and smaller individualized problems. Absolutely. No, that makes complete sense. Something that just came to mind. And I don't want to like get into it too deeply, but a point you mentioned again that really did spark a point in my brain was this idea of like the kind of generational difference in regards to kind of each, I guess, generation of people from, you know, the Punjab and from India and from Asia more widely. But I think it's definitely a pattern that we see with all kinds of migration, even in more modern recent migrations with people from West Africa, say, as we move down the generations and we fight, you know, racism and systemic issues, we do it in a very different way. You know, the Black Lives Matter movement of today, it wouldn't have happened in the 50s when the Windrush generation had to fight for what they needed and wanted. And I think it's important to, I guess, note the generational difference within the Asian community in Southall, as well as just thinking about it in a wider context. But I did, yeah, definitely thought of that sparked a thought in my mind.
Yeah, I think, yeah, part of that is probably because we think the government, the state, and I guess public institutions think about ethnicity and race and completely and communities in completely different terms now.
Yeah.
So I think that might have some impact in what is possible.
Definitely.
But I think there's probably a really good sort of thesis or article to be written about those changing cultures of anti-racism in Britain.
Yeah.
And from the Windrush. And yeah, I think while we talk about connections, like, what happens in Southall is not possible without the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Like that sort of activism. I like in the period I study, anti-racism activism, the ideas, the force comes from the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And if we were to characterize anti-racism activism now, maybe the locus of blackness in Britain is no longer the Caribbean. It might be moving to West Africa.
Yeah.
It might be moving to communities that migrated at a later date, yeah, have a different class identity. So like Caribbean migration, maybe in this period, working class men and women coming over, with immigration laws changing.
Yeah.
People who come over now maybe have professional qualifications.
Of course.
They have a job offer. They have wealth to support, money to support themselves.
Mm.
And that changes it changes anti-racism. Definitely. It changes like the scope of it as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And it takes away kind of, or changes the element of class, which I think is very big in definitely the kind of initial anti-racist movements, which really did, a lot of them came out of a socialist, you know, perspective. But if you're coming with wealth, that's not, you're going to be your political leaning necessarily. And so, yeah, definitely that generational and regional global shift, you know, impacting how we go against racism. And I think we are nearing the end of this podcast. I feel like this conversation could go to part 7 even.
There's just so much. It's really enjoyable. It's so much to talk about.
Absolutely. And I think as well, as I've kind of mentioned, when we're thinking about the curriculum and what, you know, younger listeners that are might be listening, hello to you all, that you hear about at school, these aren't the stories you get. You know, if you do manage to get a little injection of Black history in your curriculum, it does tend to be Windrush. It does tend to be these very recent histories. And it tends to be a few individuals that get kind of uplifted. And the Southall Black Sisters are not something I even heard about till more, you know, a really late point in my studies. I didn't study Black British history at the beginning. It was more Caribbean. So yeah, this, I didn't know about this stuff. And I think in terms of like public history and how, you know, Britain kind of looks at itself or doesn't, because it, institutional racism doesn't exist, you know, in that kind of context, these stories are vital when we look at like anti-racism and race relations in Britain. We have to look at Asian people, we have to look at those stories, we have to look at Asian people coming from Africa, you know, we have to look at these wider narratives, I think. And it's really important that you're doing this work to kind of, and I think that will fit in beautifully with this wider narrative that historians and scholars have been building up over the past like 20 and 30 years. So it's wonderful. Definitely. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today. Before you go, tell us what's next for you or what you're doing right now in terms of the history world. And also at the end, where to find you, your socials and websites.
Cool. So what I'm doing right now is I am attempting to write up my thesis from my bedroom. for the last year. Yeah. It's going well. It's pretty full on. But yeah, it's there was things I could be doing right now. Otherwise, yeah, I'm just trying to stay sane.
Always.
And I'm on Twitter at his name is Satya. My website is also his name is Satya.
Easy.
In case you ever forget my name. And I think the last thing I would say is on Southall Black Sisters is they are an organization at last till today. They're still providing essential resources to women who are in distress or in trouble. They still work out of Southall. They have a website, and you know, they fundraise, they do a lot of things, and it doesn't come cheap. And I would encourage you all, if you're listening to this podcast, to check out their website, look at what they do, and you know, if you support in any way, it's probably very good.
Yeah, definitely. We had it was International Women's History Month last month. We had different kind of charities that we kind of brought to the forefront, and Sister Space was one of them in Hackney. But definitely, the Southall Black Sisters are a charity that should be supported and funded. And I'll put their details in all relevant posts, as well as Satya's social media details, as well as that interview that he did earlier on this year, so that you can find him and follow all his fantastic work. Thank you so much.
Can I say thank you for having me? And you're an excellent podcast host.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it.
I'm glad. I think podcasts are quite cool with history because, as you said, you know, you spend so long just reading and writing in an isolated manner.
Yeah.
To be able to kind of say it all out and just, you know, verbalize everything, sometimes it can be helpful. So I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thank you so much for being here today. Wow, what an episode. Honestly, I feel like I learned so much again in those two parts, and I'm glad that I split them, I guess, into two parts, because there was just so much food for thought and so much information shared by Satya. So Satya, thank you so much for being part of this migration series. You know, different to the Seychelles episode in the sense that we looked more at, in the context of the Seychelles, the history of the country, and not so much like community forming, because as we said, it was a hidden population and the forming of community is different when you don't have those numbers. But in the case of the Punjab and Southall and Southall Black Sisters, a movement that was clearly born out of that migration, I think it's a lot easier to see when the population is visible, as we've spoken about. And, you know, thinking about that report that was written by the government and a quote unquote lack of institutional racism or it not existing in Britain anymore, which we obviously know is a load of nonsense. But yeah, I hope you got to understand maybe this perspective of a historian that is currently in the archives, currently doing this work. And obviously Satya's writing up his PhD thesis, to which we wish him the best of luck. And I hope that all goes well, Satya. So thank you so much for being on this episode, these two episodes that it turned into. And I hope for all of you listening, you were kind of able to take a bit of an alternative look at Black history as we looked at the South Asian perspective, which doesn't naturally fit into this discourse and into this narrative and is often excluded, but is equally as important for sure. So please, again, follow Satya at his socials. Everything will be linked in the show notes and also on social media. And follow the History Hotline, as always, on all good podcast platforms and on LinkedIn, Twitter and Instagram. Have a wonderful week. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.
Moro Casino. American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at rss.com.